This audio is brought to you by MuslimCentral.com.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Alhamdulillah wa salatu wa salam ala rasulillah. So alhamdulillah, we reached the end of the series. Before I begin, I just want to thank everybody for attending. When I had this idea for the series and I spoke to Muhammad about it, I told him, even if 5 people attend, we have in the class. So I wasn't expecting, alhamdulillah, the crowd that we got. I'm really, really grateful to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala for giving us this opportunity to discuss these issues. And remember, this six-part series isn't really fatwas. It's just opening the doors of discussion. That's basically what we're doing. We're laying the groundwork for future discussion and future delving deeper into these topics. This is just an introduction to what actually can happen in the world of fiqh. And I really hope that what we've studied over these 6 weeks will open people's minds to just how dynamic fiqh is. You know, one of the reasons why we don't need modernism, you know, modernism is the idea that Islam has to change with the times. The reason we don't need modernism is because fiqh is like this. Fiqh is such that it's adaptable to every culture, every situation, every necessity. It takes into consideration all these different things. So the laws are always changing. That's why we don't need modernism, right? So for those people who believe that Islam has to modernize, it doesn't. We just have to go back to our roots. We have to go back to using our principles to derive our opinions instead of just memorizing opinions. So today, inshallah, we're going to cover the sixth and the final of the main usul of the Hanafi madhab, which is the principle of istihsan, right? Istihsan. So again, to begin, quick recap. We said that the principles of fiqh are divided into three types: the revealed sources, which all of the madhabs agree upon, the Quran and the Sunnah, and the secondary sources, which all of the primary madhabs agree upon, ijma and qiyas. Now, some of the secondary madhabs, like the Zahiri madhab, don't accept these. But we're talking about the primary madhabs, the ones that make up the majority of the ummah. We said in the Hanafi madhab, there are two more principles of fiqh which are not found in these exact terminology in other madhabs. Now, what's interesting is these concepts are found in the other madhabs. They may just have other terms for it, right? These two are urf and istihsan. So urf we covered last week. What's urf? Customs and culture. Right, that Islam is adaptable to every culture and it takes into consideration the customs and the norms of a society. I actually was reading yesterday one of the Hanafi Usul al-Fiqh books, a very interesting example of that, right? The author, it's a very old book, maybe like a 1,000-year-old Usul al-Fiqh book, and the author says about the verse, don't say uff to your parents. Right? He says about this verse means you should not harm your parents in any way. So he says, if it becomes the urf of a society sometime in the future, that the word uff is a term of respect, it will become halal in that society to use the word uff with your parents. This is how urf works, right? That it's not taking the Quran and Sunnah literally, it's understanding what is Allah telling us. Allah is not talking about a specific word, He's talking about a mindset, right? Being harmful to your parents. So it's very interesting how the Hanafi madhab from the beginning considered urf as a primary source of fiqh, that even how they understand the Quran is affected by urf. So today we come to the final of the major usul of fiqh, and that is istihsan. Now there are other secondary principles of fiqh we did not get a chance to discuss. Things like, can we take fiqh from the sharia of previous prophets? Right? From the sharia of Yusuf alayhi salam or Musa alayhi salam. That's another area of dispute. Can we take fiqh from the opinions of the Sahaba? That's another area of dispute, right? Again, that's all very high-level detailed things to go into. I wanted to focus primarily on the main principles and ones that can solve our problems. So today's principle is istihsan. Before I give the definition, can someone give me your own idea? What do you think istihsan is? Maybe you read it in a book somewhere or heard in a lecture or just from the word itself. What do you think istihsan is? Public good. Okay. Any other definitions? Right, so the word hasan means what is good. Istihsan means to seek something good. Right? These letters in Arabic, alif, seen, and ta, when it's added at the beginning of a verb, it means to seek something. right? To seek assistance, istainu, isti'ana, right? Means to seek assistance. So istihsan means to seek what is good or to seek what is better. That's the literal definition of this word, to seek that which is better. In fiqh, it is defined as going against the conclusion of qiyas or providing an exception to the conclusion of qiyas when that conclusion contradicts either the text or the goals of the sharia. So obviously to understand this, we have to understand the goals of the sharia, which we will discuss in the next slide. But let's just look at the definition first. We said that the fourth principle of fiqh is qiyas, right? Now, do we always have to follow qiyas? According to all of the madhabs, no. If your qiyas contradicts the text or the goals of the sharia, then you don't follow that qiyas. And we're going to look at many examples of that. But there's a beautiful statement from Ibn Qayyim al-Jawziyyah rahimahullah that really summarizes the concept of istihsan. And I mentioned it in the very first lecture that we gave in the series. And really, this is really istihsan in action. Ibn Qayyim rahimahullah said, the sharia is founded upon wisdom and welfare for the servant in this life and the afterlife. In its entirety, it is justice, mercy, benefit and wisdom. These are the goals of the sharia. Justice, mercy, benefit and wisdom. So listen, this is, now we're talking about istihsan. When qiyas goes against the goals of the sharia, we overrule qiyas. So see what Ibn Qayyim says. He says, any matter that abandons justice for tyranny, mercy for cruelty, benefit for corruption and wisdom for foolishness is not a part of the sharia, even if it was introduced by an interpretation. Meaning, even if this is your qiyas, if your qiyas is leading to a result that causes tyranny or cruelty or corruption or foolishness or anything that goes against the goals of the sharia, then it is not what Allah wanted us to do. So this is where istihsan comes in. Istihsan is, what if I made qiyas and the result is something that's really going to make life difficult for society or cause problems in society? Then we say that we need to overrule that qiyas, and there is a list of principles for doing so. This is called istihsan. But to understand istihsan, we first need to understand the goals of the sharia. Now next year, inshallah, we'll do 6 weeks on the goals of the sharia, but I want to just summarize them in 5 minutes, if that's possible. This is another beautiful field of study, maqasid al-sharia, the goals of the sharia. And when I first studied this, it completely revolutionized my approach to fiqh. Firstly, I had finished my alim course for several years before I even heard this term. So when I first heard of it, I was shocked. I was like, this is some kind of modernist thing, what's going on here? I'd never heard of this before. So I read the books on the topic. Books by classical Maliki scholars like Ash-Shatibi, classical Hanafi scholars like Shah Wali Ullah Dehlawi. Right, so I'm not reading modernist books, I'm reading literal classical literature on this topic. And from here I learned about the goals of the sharia. So what the goals of the sharia basically teaches us is that Allah did not reveal the sharia for nothing. It's not just a bunch of random laws that, you know, Allah is making things haram or wajib because, you know, he wants to test us only. That is one reason, but there is wisdom. We believe Allah is Al-Hakim, He is most wise. Therefore, there is wisdom behind the laws of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. So these scholars have analyzed these laws to derive what are these wisdoms. What is the end goal? Why did Allah want us to do this? What are we supposed to get out of it? Right? That end goal or that thing that you get out of that law is called the goal or the maqsad of that specific law. From there, they went deeper and they analyzed the goals of the sharia as a whole. So first, they analyzed specific laws. Right? Like Imam Al-Ghazali did this in his Ihya Ulumuddin. Right, so for example, he shows how salah is supposed to increase our taqwa and our remembrance of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. So this is a goal of salah. And he showed the same thing with fasting and hajj. Anyone who has been through Imam Ghazali's books knows that this is his approach. He focuses on the goal of the act of worship. Don't just do it ritually. Right? Later scholars, they focus on the sharia as a whole. What are the goals of the sharia as a whole? And one of the recent scholars, the great Maliki jurist, Ibn Ashur, rahimahullah, who is from the previous century, from literally the 20th century, passed away in the 1960s. He has a beautiful book on Maqasid al-Sharia. And in this book, he summarizes the goals of the Sharia in one beautiful sentence. He says that the Sharia as a whole revolves around two things. attainment of benefits and prevention of harm. This is the Sharia. Any law that Allah has revealed is either something that benefits us or something that protects us from harm. This is the Sharia. Literally any law that Allah has revealed is something that benefits us or protects us from harm, or it does both. So this becomes the primary goal of the Sharia. The attainment of benefit and the prevention of harm. And the prevention of harm is considered the higher goal of the Sharia. Meaning when there is a clash, when something benefits you but it harms the rest of society, it is generally considered haram. Right? Because prevention of harm comes first. Going deeper, the scholars of Maqasid, they divided the goals of the Sharia into three types. The durura, the necessities, the hajat, the needs, and the tahsiniyat, the luxuries. Now again, next year we'll discuss these in details. Basically, they put things at different levels. So necessities are things that humans cannot live without. Needs are the things that you needed to fulfill the necessities. So for example, one of the necessities is wealth. So wealth is one of the necessities in the Sharia. A need would be a job. You need a job to have wealth, in most cases. Right? A luxury is something beyond that. Right? So having a nice house, having a nice car, in terms of wealth. So you have necessities, needs, and luxuries. Again, we'll discuss this next year. It literally will take an entire hour to discuss those three topics. Right? So our Sharia revolves around the protection of the necessities. This is where istihsan comes in. Istihsan is primarily if any law or qiyas goes against any of the necessities. What are the necessities? We'll come to that in a moment. If any of the laws of a specific qiyas violate one of the necessities, then it's overridden. Now, what are these necessities? Again, there's difference of opinion because this is something the ulama have derived and understood. It's not listed in the Quran or in the Hadith. But in general, we can say most of the ulama who wrote about this topic, they wrote about five or six necessities in general, right? These five or six, number one is religion. Religion is of two types. Number one, protecting Islam itself overrides anything else. Protecting Islam itself from being corrupted, from being lost, from being destroyed, that overrides anything else. Number two, protecting the iman of people. That's the other meaning of protection of religion. Our religion revolves around protecting our iman. An example of this is salah. When we pray five times a day, we protect our iman. When we stop praying, our iman starts to disappear. For man tarakahu faqad kafara. The Prophet ﷺ said, whoever abandons salah will leave the religion. Right? So, this is protection of religion. Number two is human life. Do no harm. So our religion is a religion of protection of human life. This is number two. The religion overrides this. Right? This is why jihad is allowed. Because jihad is what? It's about protecting the religion from being destroyed. When people are attacking a Muslim land or trying to wipe out the Muslims of a society, for the Muslims to fight back to protect their religion, even though human lives will be lost in the process, right? But this is the protection of religion takes precedence over the protection of human life, and the protection of human life takes precedence over anything else. So many, many things that are normally haram become halal if they are needed to protect human life. And I'm sure you're familiar with the examples of pork and alcohol, that they become halal to protect human life, right, when it's necessity. Intellect. Right? So alcohol and drugs are prohibited because they mess with our minds. So anything, any kind of substance that is going to mess up a person's mind is prohibited because our intellect is a gift from Allah that needs protection. It's a necessity. You cannot function in society without it. You see what happens to people who are addicted to drugs. Right? You see what happens to their brains. They're unable to fulfill the basic necessities of life. So this is why intellect itself is one of the necessities that the religion was sent to protect. Number four, the scholars worded it differently. Ash-Shatibi calls it lineage, Al-Ghazali calls it honor, Ibn Ashur calls it family. And that's what I'm going to go with, family. Because family is lineage and honor put together. Right? So the protection of lineage, honor and family. This is why zina is prohibited. This is why marriage is encouraged. Because it protects the family, it protects the individual's honor. It keeps the family together. So protecting families. This is why our religion is so strong on family rights, the rights of the parents, the rights of the children, the rights of the spouse, the rights of your distant relatives. Family is a major thing in our religion. It's a necessity of life. And finally, wealth ownership. And this is why it is an oxymoron to be a Muslim communist. Right? Because wealth ownership is a fundamental right in our religion. People have the right to own their own wealth, to build it up, and to just keep growing it. Obviously, they have to pay zakat, they should give charity as well. But nobody can come and say, you're not allowed to own that much money, give a quarter of it away, or give half of it away, or give all of it away. Wealth ownership is a necessity in our religion. It's one of those things that the religion was sent to protect. Our religion has laws in place for the protection of wealth ownership. The most basic law being don't steal. We're not allowed to steal, right? So, basically what istihsan is? Istihsan means, when any fatwa or qiyas violates one of these five things, then we override it. Meaning, if someone's qiyas is going to threaten the religion, or a human life, or the protection of intellect, or the preservation of family, or the preservation of wealth ownership, in each of these cases, we will override it through istihsan. Again, it's a very technical subject. Hope you're able to stay with me thus far. Before we move on, does everyone understand, just on a basic level, what are the goals of the Sharia? Have you heard of this topic before? Raise your hands if you've heard of the goals of the Sharia. Raise your hands if you've never heard of it. Okay. This is a subtopic we have to teach our communities. Really, imagine if in school, we are teaching children, we pray Salah because of this. We have laws because of that. Zina is haram because of protection of lineage and honor. I mean, we just tell kids zina is haram. And they see it all over the TV and they want to do it. What if we actually teach them the goals behind it? And wouldn't that be a far stronger preventative measure? So this is a field that has to be revived in our times. In the past, it was studied and taught by ulama. Nowadays, I think it needs to be taught at every level of society. So now, why did I say istihsan is disputed? In the early years, there was some difference of opinion on whether istihsan is allowed or not. The very first book on usul al-fiqh, al-risala, written by Imam al-Shafi. Right? So Imam al-Shafi wrote the first book on usul al-fiqh. In that book, he has a whole section criticizing istihsan and saying that it's not allowed. But Imam Abu Hanifa allowed it. Imam Malik allowed it, but he called it something else. He called it istislah or maslaha, right? Attainment of benefits. And Ahmad ibn Hanbal, there seem to be different narrations from him. So the early Hanbalis also had differences of opinion, right? Some Hanbalis said it's allowed, some said it's not allowed. Ibn Taymiyyah came along and he showed that Imam Ahmad ibn Hanbal did do istihsan, therefore it is part of the Hanbali madhab as well. So today it's generally accepted amongst the Hanbalis as well. So the early Shafi madhab did not really have a concept of istihsan until the time of Imam al-Ghazali. Imam al-Ghazali proved that this is part of the Shafi madhab, and that perhaps Imam al-Shafi did not understand what was meant by istihsan. Because when you read Imam Ghazali's criticism, he seems to be criticizing a literal understanding of the word, not his exact concept. This exact concept is something he did himself. He just called it qiyas. Right? He wasn't criticizing the idea of focusing on the goals of the Sharia. He was criticizing the idea of giving preference based on your own intellect. So Imam al-Ghazali said istihsan is part of the Shafi'i madhab. It's just not given that name. It's not called istihsan. But the idea that you override a ruling because of the goals of the Sharia, it's there. It's there in all four madhabs. They just have different names for it. So we can say every madhab has a method of overriding qiyas based on the maqasid, but they have different names for it. In the Hanafi and Hanbali madhab, we call it istihsan. In the Maliki madhab, it's called maslaha or istisla. In the Shafi madhab, it's considered part of qiyas. It's not given a separate name. In recent times, you will find more and more ulama turning towards istihsan. From all the mazhabs and even from those who don't follow a mazhab. Why? Because we are living in a time where things are just, difficult in terms of fiqh. Many things that people took for granted in the past, are not so clear-cut anymore. And many things that exist today do not exist in the past. And so we find that there are many, many cases today where ulama can't just rely on qiyas. They have to find another way to fulfill the goals of the Sharia. And so you will find that this concept of istihsan or maslaha popping up all the time in discussions amongst ulama. Okay, so how do we know this is allowed? How do you know you can just override qiyas based on what you assume is the goals of the Sharia? Again, there are many evidences. I will mention two hadiths and two narrations from the life of Umar radiallahu anhu. So the Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam, when he conquered Makkah, he told Aisha radiallahu anha that the shape of the Kaaba is not its original shape. Right? The original shape of the Kaaba was what? Anyone knows? It was a rectangle, close to like a rectangle. Right? So it was longer. So the Prophet said that that is the shape of the Kaaba. But Aisha then asked him, so why don't we just rebuild it in that way? Right? Qiyas demands, if that's the original shape of the Kaaba, why not put it back in that way? The Prophet said that the people of Makkah have just converted to Islam. The first thing I go do is bulldoze the Kaaba to rebuild it. What are they going to think? Right? So to preserve the iman of the people of Makkah, he did not follow his qiyas, which is to build the Kaaba in its original form. Right? So here he focused not on what qiyas demands, which is to rebuild the Kaaba in its original form, but on preserving the iman of the people of Makkah. Right? Which is one of the goals of the Sharia, preservation of iman, preservation of religion. Second example. The Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam said he knows the names of all the hypocrites living in Medina. People who are fake Muslims, spies, people pretending to be Muslims. So of course Umar radiallahu anhu said, why don't we chop their heads off? If we know this guy is a kafir, we know he's lying, we know he's a spy, we know he's infiltrating us, why not chop his head off? Qiyas demands you execute him for treason. Right? What did the Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam say? He said, if I do that, people will say that Muhammad kills his companions. I mean, think about it today. Think about it today, the Islamophobes and the Islamophobic websites. Imagine if there were a narration saying so-and-so took his shahada and immediately the Prophet ﷺ called Umar to chop his head off. Imagine what a field day they'd have with that. So the Prophet ﷺ having foresight, listen, people are going to think like this. They're not going to know what he knows. This is ilmul ghaib, this is knowledge of the unseen that he had, that these people are hypocrites. The rest of the world can't see this. What the rest of the world sees is, this person is taking his shahada, he's becoming a Muslim, he's moving to Medina, and then the Prophet has his head chopped off. So, to protect the iman of people till the end of time, he just let them go, let the hypocrites live their lives, left the punishment for the akhirah. The best example of a sahabi who did a lot of istihsan is Umar radiallahu anhu. The reign of Umar ibn al-Khattab radiallahu anhu has been studied by scholars of usul al-fiqh in many different angles. From the goals of the Sharia, the maxims of fiqh, istihsan, urf. Why? Because Umar was one of those sahaba who didn't just follow what the Prophet ﷺ said. He literally went against what the Prophet ﷺ said, even what the Quran said in many times, when he felt that the goals of the Sharia were in a different direction. So really, you know, if you want to study fiqh historically, and study a historical example of someone who understood fiqh and understood how flexible it was, the life of Umar radiallahu anhu is probably the best example of this. I'll just give two examples for now, but they're like over a dozen examples from his life that we can look at. Number one, when there was a drought, Umar prohibited the chopping of the hands of thieves. Now the Quran says, chop off the hands of thieves, right? The male thief and the female thief, amputate the hand. This is in the Quran. But in the time of Umar, during the time of famine, he said, we're not going to do this. Why? Preservation of human life. In the time of famine, why are people stealing? Because people are dying. People are dying. They're literally dying, so they are stealing. So he says, it's a time of durura, a time of necessity. So we will not apply this law now. When the drought was over, when the famine was over, when the economy returned to its normal level, then he started applying the law again. Example number two, preservation of family. The Quran says that men are allowed to marry chaste women from the Jews and Christians. Right? In the time of Umar, he did not allow it. Why? Because the Muslim men were choosing Jewish and Christian wives over Muslim women. And so the Muslim women were not getting married. So to preserve their honor, to preserve their rights of marriage, to preserve their rights to have a family, because really the rights of the Muslim woman in terms of having a family is one of the goals of the Sharia, Umar did not allow it. And so, right till today, in different situations, you will have different rulings. So for example, in an Islamic society where a man marrying a Christian woman is not going to affect his children's iman or anything like that, and she's a chaste practicing Christian, it may be allowed. But in a country where it's more likely children will end up Christian, with the mom being Christian, we'd say it's not allowed. So what Umar radiallahu anhu showed us here is that this, even though Allah says in the Quran, you are allowed to marry the chaste woman of the Jews and Christians, it's not a set law. It depends on situation, it depends on whether it's going to fulfill the goals of the Sharia or not. And so the law keeps changing depending on the situation. So really, the reign of Umar ibn al-Khattab radiallahu anhu is the best example of istihsan. He did it over and over and over again in many different issues. I'll give one more example that's not there. Zakah on horses. The Prophet ﷺ did not charge zakah on horses. In the reign of Umar, he started charging zakah on horses. This is literally, you know, if you're someone who takes things too literally, this is literally going against the sunnah. The Prophet ﷺ did not charge zakah on horses, Umar did. Why? Because the economy changed. In the time of the Prophet ﷺ, horses were a necessity of war. If you're going to be giving zakah on horses, you're giving one horse away for every few horses you own, you're going to have less horses for jihad. In the time of Umar, horses were big business. So the businessman whose property was horses and nothing else, didn't have to pay zakah. Right? So they found a loophole. Now instead of going into the sheep business or the camel business, going to the horse business. Because now there's no zakah. So he says, it's a different situation. When horses were for war only, no zakah. Horses are now wealth and property like sheep, camels, and those kind of things, and a very valuable property. There is zakah. So you see, Umar radiallahu anhu did not take the Quran and the Sunnah and the laws of Islam in this very inflexible manner. He always looked at why. Why did the Prophet say this? Why did Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala reveal this? What's the goals? Is it achieving these goals today? And accordingly, he either followed the law or he changed it. And really we could do this entire lecture just on Umar, because he really is the one who we get all of these ideas from. His reign is probably the best example of istihsan in the history of Islam. And really, you know, the way we teach the life of Umar, it's not just to him. Well, think about most of us, when you think about Umar, we think of this angry guy, right? He's a wise, intelligent man. So wise and intelligent that the Prophet ﷺ said, had there been a prophet after me, it would have been Umar. Such an intelligent man that the Prophet ﷺ said, some people are inspired by Allah and Umar is one of those people. And so this is a man of deep thought, deep understanding of the religion, great care for society, great care for fulfilling the goals of the Sharia. And the only story we know about him is the chopping of people's heads and slapping people around. That's really, really an injustice to his life. And we need to really revise how we study his life, because there's so many beautiful stories like this that show what a deep thinker he was and how he understood the Sharia to be. Okay. Coming to the main part of today's discussion, when do we make istihsan? What are the legitimate reasons for istihsan? Now, I'm not going to go into the obvious ones. We said when it contradicts the text of the Quran or the Sunnah. Now, that's the obvious one. So, istihsan bil Quran, istihsan bil Sunnah, istihsan bil Ijma. All of that's quite obvious. If Qiyas is saying one thing and the Quran is saying something else, you go with the Quran, right? Rather, we're going into the maqasid side. What are the goals of the Sharia? That if your qiyas contradicts it, you look for a different fatwa. So I put up six of them from what I gathered through my research, and this week I read many different research papers on this topic. I came through across basically six, which I found in most of these papers. Number one is the removal of harm. So we said the main goal of the Sharia is the removal of harm. Almost the entire fiqh of haram is based on the removal of harm. Allah has prohibited alcohol because it is harmful. He has prohibited murder because it is harmful. He prohibited fornication because it is harmful. So therefore, when the results of qiyas is harmful, you don't follow that qiyas. Right? So there's two Arabic words for harm. In maqasid it's called mafsada. In maxims of fiqh it's called darar. Right? So the removal of darar or the removal of mafsada, that's number one. And of course the opposite as well. We said the other goal of the Sharia is the attainment of benefit, maslaha. And this principle in the Maliki Mazhab is called maslaha. Right? In the Maliki Mazhab, this principle is not called istihsan, it's called maslaha. Right? Which means, what maslaha means is, humans can make their own laws that are beneficial to society as long as they don't contradict the Quran and Sunnah. I'm going to give three examples of maslaha in the next slide. Right? It is permissible to make our own laws if they don't contradict the Quran and Sunnah. Clear example where nobody disagrees, a school making its own rules. Is that haram? Is this not ruling by the laws of Allah? No, it's clear. You can make rules as long as there's benefit and removal of harm in it. Right? Number 3 and 4, these are two areas where people get confused and people are, in general don't know the difference between these two areas. Mashaqqa and darura. Unreasonable difficulty and necessity. So two of the maxims of fiqh. Al-mashaqqa tu tajlibu taysir. That unreasonable difficulty causes the law to relax. And the other one, al-darura tu hibbul mahdurat. Necessity makes the haram halal. These are two separate maxims in fiqh. Unreasonable difficulty causes the law to relax. Necessity makes the haram halal. What's the difference? Take a guess, what's the difference between mashaqqa and darura? Darura is usually life and death situations, right? Mashaqqa is just unreasonable difficulty. What's unreasonable difficulty? For example, if you can't stand and pray, what does the Sharia allow? Sit. Is that a matter of life and death? No, it's just mashaqqa. It's just it's difficulty, right? It's an unreasonable difficulty. If it's too cold to make wudu and you're going to get a flu or cold if you make wudu, you're allowed to make tayammum. Why? Mashaqqa, right? Unreasonable difficulty. So, you know, you're allowed to shorten your prayers when traveling because of mashaqqa, because of unreasonable difficulty. Darura is a matter of life and death. Darura is, for example, if you don't do this, someone will die. If you don't do this, somebody is going to lose a limb, or somebody is going to lose their wealth, or somebody is going to lose one of the five goals of the Sharia, one of the five necessities. Remember we said, the number one level of goals of the Sharia are the daruriyat, the necessities. So darura is when one of these five is threatened, usually it's human life. So this leads to two different levels of law. Mashaqqa makes minor sins halal. Darura can make major sins halal. For example, in general, you are not allowed to sit and pray. Is that a major or minor sin to sit and pray? Minor. But it becomes allowed because of mashaqqa. Eating pork, is that a major or minor sin? Major. That only becomes allowed if you are dying and there is literally nothing else to save your life. You see the difference? An inconvenience can make a minor sin allowed. A matter of life and death can make a major sin allowed. And this is why it's important for ulama to know the difference between major and minor sins. And again, nowadays we don't know the difference. Why? Because we all use the term haram. And we don't divide haram into major and minor sin. So when we're teaching our children, we teach them murder is haram, wearing your pants below the ankle is haram. Right? So they're like, murder and pants below the ankles are in the same category. They're just as bad as each other. That's what's going to go through their mind. Because we're not explaining it. We're not breaking it down into subcategories. We have to explain these different levels of haram. Right? And so different levels become allowed because of different things. I'm going to give examples of both in the next slide. Number 5 is adala, justice. So go back to the statement of Ibn Qayyim al-Jawziyyah. Whatever moves away from justice towards tyranny is not allowed, even if that's the result of your qiyas. So when someone's opinion is going to lead to injustice, we have to relook the issue and see is there another way. And finally, the Hanafi mazhab urf. Urf can be part of istihsan. There is a concept in the Hanafi mazhab called istihsan bil urf, right? Overriding qiyas based on local culture. Meaning, when there is a clash between qiyas and culture, most of the mazhabs will go with qiyas. The Hanafi mazhab, in many cases, will go with local culture. Right? And I already gave the example of that earlier. If you remember, the verse of the Quran, don't say uf to them. The Hanafi understanding of that verse shows that urf can override even what seems to be the qiyas based on a verse of the Quran. Okay, the examples. So the examples I'm going to give are covering all of these to some extent or the other. So, istihsan, why am I teaching about this? A very complex thing, very complicated thing. Why am I teaching it? I believe this can be used to solve many, many contemporary issues. And because we are not using it, we have fatwas that are just making life unnecessarily difficult upon us. And the opinions I'm going to mention now are not my opinions. the opinions from leading ulama across the globe. I've researched each of these things, and I've read papers, and I've read fatwa committees of Saudi Arabia, the United Kingdom, United States. All these countries have fatwa committees. Ulama get together from all the madhabs and discuss these issues and then issue a fatwa. Right? And so these are actually their conclusions, many a times based on istihsan. Number one, insurance being allowed due to necessity. Now, qiyas, according to any madhab, qiyas demands that insurance is haram. Why? Because insurance contains two haram things, gharar and riba. Gharar means you don't know what you're getting for your money. In Islam, if you are buying something and you don't know what you're getting in exchange for it, that's haram. And by the way, for the young video gamers here, that includes buying a loot box with real money. Right? When you're buying a loot box in a game with real money, you don't know what you're getting. That's actually gharar, that's actually haram. You're wasting real money. Right? Only the young guys will know what I'm talking about.
What?
Gharar is found in insurance. You don't know. I mean, you're paying every month. Is there any guarantee you're going to get anything? How much is it going to be? You don't know. It's really the luck of the drawer. And number two, there's riba. There's obviously riba involved in the whole process. So, in general, all of the madhabs say that insurance is haram, but... This is what they say. It's haram, but... But what? Besides life insurance, for every other type of insurance, the ulama have allowed it due to necessity, or in some cases due to mashaqqa, due to unreasonable difficulty. Right? So, for example, life insurance. If you are living in a country where good medical care is expensive, it is literally a matter of life or death whether you have life insurance or not. So that overrides the issue of it being haram. But sometimes it's just mashaqqa. For example, car insurance. Technically, you can say it's not a matter of life and death. You can use an Uber, right? You can find some other way. But it's a matter of mashaqqa, because if you're going to say no Muslims in this country are allowed to own cars because there's car insurance involved and car insurance is haram, imagine the level of difficulty you're going to cause to an entire community. Right? So their mashaqqa, unreasonable difficulty, overrides the ruling, and we say it's allowed due to mashaqqa. Right? So we must understand this. When we say that these things are allowed, we do not mean they're allowed in of themselves. It doesn't mean that Muslims must go and set up their own insurance companies or work for the insurance companies or, you know, be part of this or try and introduce it to countries that don't have it. No, it means you're living in a country where this is a necessity, this is a matter of mashaqqa or the rura, so the law for you is different. And again, the law can change from person to person depending on their situation. An example of mashaqqa is credit cards. Right? So according to most of the madhabs, not really the Hanafi madhab, but all the other madhabs, if you're going to follow the rules of qiyas, credit cards are technically haram. Why not the Hanafi madhab? Because in the Hanafi madhab in general, if there's a haram condition in the contract is allowed, but the condition is not. Right? But the other madhabs, many of them say the whole contract is thrown out. So, what haram condition is found in the contract you signed for a credit card? You're going to pay riba if you don't pay back in time. You're literally signing a contract saying, I'm going to pay the riba if I don't pay back in time. This condition is haram. Therefore, qiyas demands that credit cards are haram. Nonetheless, every fatwa committee I checked with says that credit cards are allowed because of mashaqqa. You can't function without them today. Now, if somebody can, they should. If somebody can live without the credit card, do that, that's probably, you know, alhamdulillah, good for you. But it's really a matter of mashaqqa. So, for example, I run an online business. It's literally impossible to set up an online business without a credit card, because literally every single step requires purchases of software and that requires a credit card, ongoing credit card transactions. So if you're going to say you're not allowed to own a credit card, not a single Muslim will be able to set up an online business. Right? What about traveling? And hire a car, you know, then when you arrive for your booking, they want to check your credit card to make sure it's you. You know, I mean, if you don't own credit cards, traveling becomes mashaqqa, becomes unreasonably difficult. So if in traveling you're allowed to combine your salah, you're allowed to shorten your salah, this is also a matter of mashaqqa. Right? So, you will find this ruling in all of the madhabs nowadays, that credit cards in of themselves are technically, they have a haram condition, but we allow them because of mashaqqa. Because if we're going to say it's haram, we are making life unnecessarily difficult on people. And the Sharia did not want to make life that difficult for people. Right, so this is one of the clearest examples of mashaka in action. Okay, now let's look at maslaha. So I said that the primary goal of the sharia is the prevention of harm and the attainment of benefit. This is why it is perfectly, perfectly acceptable in our sharia for human beings to make their own traffic laws. Again, nowadays you get some smart guys saying, oh, there's no traffic laws in the Quran and Hadith, so I don't have to obey them. Right? I've heard people say things like this. Again, this is ignorance. This is a matter of public benefit and prevention of harm. Because if you don't have traffic laws, I mean, you've been to countries where they don't follow traffic laws, right? I think most of us have traveled to those kind of countries. Even here, to some extent. This is like, we can put it on a scale of, it's somewhere in the middle. It's not as bad as some of the countries on that side of the world. It's nowhere near as good as the countries on the other side of the world. We're somewhere in the middle. At least there's some level of obedience to traffic laws here. But one of the reasons a lot of Muslims here don't obey traffic laws is because they say it's not found in the Quran and Hadith. I've literally heard people tell me this. I'm like, Molana, you're driving too fast. He says, the Molana says, this is not part of our religion. It's kafir law. It's not kafir law. It's maslaha and mafsada. You're going to kill someone in a car accident. You can't say it was kafir law, right? It's a matter of maslaha and mafsada. So, not only is it allowed to make these laws become compulsory for people to obey. When a people make a law and people are within, it's not even to do with government. I mean, for example, if you are working for a company and that company makes a law, for example, they have a dress code, right? You are obligated to follow that dress code. You can't say this is kafir law. You signed the contract that you're going to work for the company. So you are now obligated to follow the dress code, right? Obviously, as long as it doesn't violate the Sharia. So it's the same with man-made laws in this area. Some people, and you see this specifically amongst the jihadists, right? They have this idea that humans are not allowed to invent any laws. Right? The jihadists have this concept they've invented called Tawheed Hakimiyah, which they believe Allah is the only one who can make laws. And they believe anyone who makes a law besides Allah is a kafir. And based on this, they have declared 99.9% of the Muslims the world kafir. Literally, they have declared 99.9% of Muslims the world kafir. This is why they have no problem bombing masjids. This is why they have no problem bombing Muslim supermarkets. Because they believe everybody is kafir besides them. On what basis? That we either make or we follow man-made laws. This is the basis. This is what they base this whole idea on. They believe that man-made laws is kufr. And anyone who either makes it or obeys it is a kafir. So technically, just by living in this country, following the laws of this land, we are kafir in their eyes. So this is a very warped and weird concept. And who were the first people to say something like that? The Khawarij. Yes, the Khawarij, the Kharijites. Right? When when Muawiyah and Ali were trying to reconcile between their differences after their civil war, the Kharijites said, this is man-made law, this is kufr. They called Muawiyah kafir, they called Ali a kafir, and they even killed Ali. Right? This is literally the same mindset that those people had, the jihadists have today. Right? And this is why it's really not a stretch to call the jihadist movement today Khawarij. Because they literally have the same mindset. They've just given it a bigger spin and invent a few more ideas around it. So this idea that man-made laws is kufr, this is not true. A man-made law that goes directly against the Quran and Sunnah, and where the person is openly rejecting the Quran and Sunnah, then and only then you can say it's kufr. So for example, if a Muslim has to say riba is halal completely in every situation, then you can say, okay, maybe that's kufr. Maybe, and then you'll just say maybe, because I'm very worried about making takfir anyone, right? But if someone is just following the law of their land, that does not automatically take them out of the fold of the religion. Not just that, but our Sharia is so flexible, it allows us to make laws in areas where Allah and the Prophet ﷺ are silent. So besides traffic laws, immigration laws fall in the same category. Again, people are very angry today. Saudi Arabia talks about bid'ah, but they have the bid'ah of passport and visa. Okay. Passport and visa is not bid'ah. It's again maslaha and mafsada. How do you keep dangerous people out of your country if you're not checking their passports and checking who's entering and who's leaving your country? How do you keep track of people like that? We live in a time where governments are forced to do this because of the matter of preventing harm, right? So this is an idea that humans invented for the prevention of harm, and is perfectly acceptable from a maslaha perspective to invent laws like this. And it becomes compulsory upon people to obey these laws. Right? It becomes compulsory upon people to obey these laws. immigration laws need to be obeyed because it is for the maslaha of the community. The one that nobody in this country takes seriously. Copyright laws, piracy. Right? Now we live in a country where how do you put it? I don't think even the police take piracy laws seriously in this country. Right? But this is something we have to think about. Again, I've heard people say there's no copyright in Islam. And for that they take my books and they give it out for free and I make a loss. As an author, I'm unable to move forward as an author because people are literally, you know, not thinking about the fact that, listen, this guy put in work, let's at least pay him what he deserves for it. So I've seen this with many people. One of my friends opened up a Islamic video company to make Islamic movies. Literally at the same fair where he was selling those videos, somebody opened up a store next to him selling pirated copies of those videos. Right? And then people took his videos and uploaded them to YouTube. Guess what? He ran at a loss year after year and he had to close down. So this is now causing genuine harm. There is harm involved here. When we don't respect things like patents and copyrights, when we just violate piracy, we are causing harm to content creators. So yes, the Quran doesn't say anything about it. The Hadith doesn't say anything about it. But from a matter of istihsan, from a matter of removal of harm, we have to consider the idea that this is something legitimate for our day and age. We live in the information age. Information today is money. Information really has more value today than any time possibly in history. You know, where people are literally selling PDF files for $200 or $300 and people are buying it because they have that much value in their eyes. Right? Because information is it's one of the most important things in the world right now. So, if we are not taking copyright laws seriously, we are harming people. We are harming people, and we are, you know, especially in the area of Islamic media, the Muslims cannot progress unless we support each other. If a Muslim makes something, buy it from them. Don't find a way to get it for free. Because when we are getting it for free, we are literally harming that individual. I have seen many companies close down because of this. Not one, I've seen many Muslim companies that could have been making a huge difference in the world today close down because people don't take copyright law seriously, they pirate their videos, and as a result, they can't make a profit. Because do you know how much money it takes just to make one Islamic video? I mean like a proper movie or animated movie. It can take over a million. Literally over a million. So if everyone's pirating it, how do they keep generating money to make more videos? So if someone's producing good work, pay them for their work. That's the best thing you can do to stimulate the Islamic economy. And it's something I do all the time myself. Okay, moving on to the issue of justice. So technically, based on qiyas, we should not be going to non-Muslim courts. I think everyone understands the qiyas that leads to that, right? Technically, based on qiyas, we shouldn't be going to non-Muslims for our rights. But in this country, how else do you get your rights? Now becomes a matter of adala, a matter of justice. I mean, if someone's owing someone money, you can't really go to a Molana to sort it out. I mean, how is he going to enforce it? How is he going to, like, you know, force him to do it? The only people who can do this in a non-Muslim country are the non-Muslim courts. So we would say that, okay, someone says, you know, it's haram to go to the non-Muslim court. We say, okay, technically it's haram, but based on istihsan, based on the sake of justice, it is allowed. Because in this country, in this situation, being a minority in a non-Muslim country, this is our only means to attain justice, to go through the local justice system, right? So, istihsan will override a person's qiyas in this case. Okay, last one, urf. Public displays of affection. So, you know, here in South Africa, we are used to seeing people walking around holding hands with their spouse. Don't try that in Saudi Arabia, right? It's a different culture. And really, it's a matter of urf. It really is a matter of urf. It's a matter of respecting different urfs. The Quran and Hadith does not have a specific definition of public displays of affection. But it does tell us not to be immoral or shameless in public. Now, what is immoral or shameless in public is really going to differ from country to country. In Saudi Arabia, you can literally be holding your wife's hand in public. Right? While in South Africa, a man could be hugging his wife in public and no one's going to think anything. Because our cultures are so different. So, even though someone's qiyas might say that, you know what, it's haram for you to hold your wife's hand in public, here the Hanafi mazhab could actually make istihsan bin urf and say, in this culture, it's really not considered shameless to hold your wife's hand in public. So, you know, we shouldn't make it an issue. Right, so that's an example of istihsan to urf. So public displays of affection, there's no set ruling on it. Whatever is the norms of the culture you are in, respect that culture. When you visit another culture, respect their culture as well. And again, it's not a matter of one culture being better than another, it's simply a matter of every culture being different. Respect what is the culture of that society. So these are examples, this is how istihsan works. And again, these aren't my opinions, these are opinions of leading ulama across the globe. Ulama like Abdullah bin Bayya, Dr. Yusuf al-Qaradawi, Sheikh Salman al-Awda, this is what I mean by leading ulama around the globe. These are the people whose fatwas I've been looking into and whose books I've been reading to learn about these topics. So I'm not really even giving any opinion of my own. It's literally just narrating from the what people call it, the big ulama. Right? With that, we come to our conclusion. Istihsan is important. It is very important in the Hanafi madhab, and technically every madhab. They have different names for it, but it's an important concept. Istihsan means that we override qiyas when it contradicts with the goals of the Sharia, and we gave many examples of that. Now, the term istihsan is disputed amongst the madhabs, but technically every madhab has a similar concept, right? Like the concept of istihsala in the Maliki madhab. And finally, we can conclude from this presentation and from this discussion that a ruling based on qiyas can be overruled, or an exception can be provided for it. Like in the example of insurance, we say insurance is haram except in cases of necessity. Right? So that's an example of an exception being provided. Right? So a ruling based on qiyas can be overruled, or an exception provided to it, if there is general benefit for society, of prevention of harm, there is a necessity, there is unreasonable difficulty, it's a matter of justice and injustice, or in some cases, not most, but in a few cases, when there is a matter of clash of cultures. Right? In all of these issues, istihsan can be done. So with that, we come to the end of today's discussion and presentation, and actually the end of this year's presentation. Inshallah, next year we will continue looking at the goals of the Sharia and the maxims, 6 weeks each, starting probably late January, early February. We'll discuss that a bit later, inshallah. But before that, any questions you have on this concept, now is the time to ask. We have about half an hour, yes.
Okay, that's right. You were speaking about the third class. Now, if under the condition that it's a necessity, it becomes halal. Now, for somebody who is now making unnecessary purchases, would it be haram for them to allow to purchase? I'm not talking about somebody who has purchased life necessities. Mm-hmm. Now, in the case of Black Friday, they buy more than they should because the price is good, it doesn't come around. And now they don't have to pay into the interest.
Yeah, so when it comes to credit cards, as soon as you cross over to the part where you're now paying interest on it, now you fall into haram. Right? So the general ruling that the ulama give about credit cards is that it's allowed, but you must pay it off on time. If you're not paying it off on time, then you're now committing a sin. Right? You're committing a sin until you meet your payments. So therefore, as Muslims, we must be reasonable when it comes to our purchases. We mustn't go overboard. Make sure you don't ever spend more on your credit card than you can pay off within a single month. Otherwise, you fall into riba, which is a sin, because in Islam, you're not allowed to take an interest-based loan. And that's technically what you've fallen into once you're paying riba on your credit card. So yes, it will become haram once you cross that point.
It's an hour on its own, but just going back to what you mentioned, one of the big stumbling blocks, there are many, but one of the big ones for the Muslim personal law in the country has been this issue of non-Muslim judges going to rule on Sharia matters.
Mm-hmm.
So if you had a group of non-Muslim judges, jurists, trained properly to apply Sharia law, like they trained everything else, and given the situation where we went about 20 years now of this law sitting and women suffering, would that be permitted?
Again, I'll have to think about it, and I'll actually have to read everything that both sides have said on the topic before I say anything. But in general, we have to look at what's going to lead to justice for our Muslim community, right? If justice is really being prevented by the situation being the way it is, then it would probably become halal. Again, I can't give a fatwa on the spot. I'd have to research this thoroughly. But in general, the Sharia revolves around justice, as we mentioned with the statement of Ibn Qayyim al-Jawziyyah. Right? So if there is genuine injustice happening because of not doing this, and this is the only way to get justice in this country, then I would say 80 or 90% chance that it would become allowed in that situation. But this is why we need ulama committees who can discuss this and who are trained to discuss this. You know, this is something that really boggles my mind. Muslims have been in the UK and USA for what, like two generations, three generations? And they already have these ulama committees, they already have ulama from all the different madhabs and those who don't follow madhab getting together, discussing, arriving at the conclusions that I just mentioned. We've been here for 300 years and we still got nothing. Right? I mean, what happened? I'm not talking about people just following rulings from books written in India. I'm talking about people actually doing what these ulama are doing in the UK and the United States. Getting together and discussing from these perspectives, discussing the maqasid, discussing the maxims, discussing justice, discussing necessity, and arriving at a conclusion. Because we don't have this, this is why these things are stuck for so long. The only way forward is to train ulama who are able to do it, and for them to set up committees who do this for us. Until then, I think these things are just going to stay stuck.
I can give information on that.
Sure.
The original demand was for having Sharia courts, or family courts. And obviously the government can't afford it, so they said no.
Okay.
So the proposal is to have assessors. So you have two assessors who can be sitting with the judge, and will advise the judge on Sharia matters. That's the position.
And that sounds fine to me, because they're going to be there. I mean, I don't understand what's the problem there. The problem is kafir is involved, right? That's basically what they want to see. Yeah. Again, fiqh is meant to be practical. That's really the nature of fiqh. The whole concept of fiqh is it's meant to be practical. And now, when we are being impractical in this way, we are only harming ourselves. Any questions from the lady side? Okay, more questions.
You mentioned that istisqa is very similar to istislah.
Yes.
What's the difference between istisqa and istislah? That's the first question. Second one, a bit more controversial. You mentioned about Sayyidina Umar radiallahu anhu.
Yes.
And you also mentioned in one of the earlier talks that the first source of Islamic law is the Quran. And he didn't just override Qiyas, he actually overrode the nas of the Quran.
Yes.
You know, the fundamental verse.
It's actually an important question you're asking.
Now, can that principle be applied to Islamic law of inheritance?
Okay.
For an example, if there's a situation in which it would be unjust to give, you know, a double share to the male than the female, using the principle of justice as an overriding factor, can the nas of the Quran be contradicted or ignored? And can a person then, in the interest of justice, give a similar share to his son and his daughter?
Okay, I'm going to discuss that question first. I've actually been thinking about this for the past few weeks, because in this society we are experiencing great injustice because of this. Because technically in the Sharia, when a man dies, his sons are supposed to look after their sisters, and they're supposed to look after their mother.
But
that doesn't happen in this culture at all, like almost never. So, you know, can that change? Now, I can't give a definite ruling. So the question was, can we override the Quran here? Because it's now a matter of injustice in our society. I can't give another way out. Yes, I know what you're saying. But again, I can't give it. Again, these things need, you know, I'm one person. I need a group of people like me to sit and discuss with each other before we can arrive at a conclusion. It's too big issues for one person to talk about on their own. But I can't give one way out that people in this community do, which is completely halal, according to all the madhabs. And that is distribute your money while you're alive. Give it out in gifts. So if you know your daughter is going to be mistreated after you die, while you're alive, buy her a car, buy her a house, give her her investment account, or however much money you wanted to have, give it to her as gifts while you are alive. You know she now has that. You know she's gotten what she deserves. So even after you die, whatever's left over, you know, so a lot of our people in our society do this. When they reach a certain age, they give their assets to their children and they keep a small amount for themselves, just enough to sustain their life for the next 20 or 30 years. And in that amount they allow to be divided according to the Sharia law. That's completely halal, according to all the mazhabs. So that is a way out for some people. But now, whether we can actually change the law itself, I cannot say that on my own. I literally will have to sit with ulama and discuss.
I'll give you another example. It was happening in our family where both the parents, you know, ranked that in the past, and he only had daughters.
Yes.
But a large percentage of the inheritance went to his brother.
Wait, that doesn't...
Yeah, because your brother will inherit.
I don't think your brother can inherit if you have daughters. I'm not sure.
No, you have daughters, but...
Yes.
No, your brother does get inherited.
I'll have to double check that one.
You get a large chunk of it. Much to the detriment of his daughters who are now orphaned,
mm-hmm.
and he's supposed to look after them, which he didn't.
Yes, because technically in Shire, he's supposed to look after them. Yes.
And, you know, that's a practical example where
yeah.
he wasn't in his control because he died early and young, mm-hmm. so he couldn't actually give his daughters, you know, while he was alive.
Look,
and that was an unjust situation.
I don't know if you can override the Quran yet. That's one example I gave of how to do it. Another example in that case, if we had a proper Sharia court system here, or a way to work with the courts, would be that we could make it compulsory on that man to give each of his daughters a certain amount of money every month, because it's now his Sharia responsibility to take care of them. So, if we can move in that direction and set up a system like that in this country, that will prevent that abuse completely. That we say, listen, you are a Muslim man, this is your duty in the Sharia, that this is your niece, and you have to give her this amount of money every month based on the urf. Obviously, whatever the urfi amount that she needs to take care of her needs. That would be another solution. So it's not something you can just jump into overriding Quran. Again, we have to first explore every single possible alternative solution. And only when there's no other alternative solutions, and that's the only way forward, then the ulama will discuss that possibility. But as long as there are alternatives, we have to first discuss the alternative and try to make them work. So as I say, it's not something I can give you an opinion on straight away. It requires discussion, it requires group discussion, it requires various ulama to get together and talk about it. But I agree with you, it is a problem. In South Africa, it is a major problem. I see it myself all around me, because I'm in a family where there's a lot of people who are orphaned, and a lot of people who either don't have a father, or don't have a mother, or don't have both. And I've seen the way things go. So it is a problem. We have to find solutions. I gave two possible solutions now. Whether what you're saying is allowed or not, I can't decide on my own.
Let's follow up on that. Say in a case where you have a son, two daughters, but comes problem, the son is a drug addict.
Yes.
Now, in the interest of justice, if he is given the money, it's going to disappear. There is no way that he's going to take care of himself,
mm-hmm.
his mother, or his siblings.
Yes. Okay, so in
that's
cases like that,
and
yeah.
it's a very common problem,
yeah.
it's much easier to rule on.
Mm.
Maybe as a start, if you could get a ruling out on that. It's a
okay, so the Sharia does have a system that deals with this. It's called ruling on the wealth of idiots. That's basically what it translates as. That's basically how you translate it. It's literally called Malu Sufaha, right? The wealth of idiots. What the Quran states is, if somebody is incompetent in taking care of their money, then somebody else is put in charge of their money, and they take care of their person. So for example, if you know someone's a drug addict, you're not allowed to give him money. Somebody else who's responsible takes his money and buys him his necessities every month. Right? So that's what will come into play, yeah. Right? So maybe an uncle or an aunt or a cousin or a grandparent, or maybe one of the sisters, will be put in charge of his money to make sure she's getting her right, her other sister's getting her right, and that he's still getting what he needs every month to take care of his religious necessities, mm-hmm. not his other habit. Right? So that's the law that will come into play, yeah. Okay. Anything else? Istidlal. I'm lost my train of thought here. What's istidlal again?
I think you're talking about istisla.
Istisla, or are you talking about istishab? You're talking about
istisla.
I have to double check istidlal. It just slipped my brain completely. I'm remembering istishab. The third one I remember is istishab. Right? Again, it just slipped my mind completely. You have the book there, right? So just pass it to me. But in Mia, any other questions?
Okay. We have another issue about divorce. The husband refuses to issue a talaq. The wife goes to court, and the court issues a talaq. Is that a talaq?
I don't know. Okay. I don't know which one will come there.
Okay, and of course, added to that is there are people who are married, but they divorce for the purpose of tenants.
Okay.
Is that a divorce?
Wow. You guys, this is how our community does, right? Why? Because it's a kafir law and all of that, right? So, you know, you're bringing up issues that we really, really have to discuss.
Islam means independence.
Okay.
Istidlal means legal instruments based on inference.
Sorry?
Legal instruments based on inference. That's istidlal.
No, istidlal is allows the jurors to avoid strict analogy in a case where no clear precedence could be found. I think it's just that's probably the Shafi version of it. That's basically it. Because the definition written here is literally exact same thing. The definition written here is literally says.
There's actually no difference between these
three terms. Every madhab basically gave it their own name. You know, that's basically what they did. Imam Shafi didn't like the word istihsan. He felt the word sounded too rationalist, like you're overriding it based on your own intelligence. So he gave it a different word. Istidlal, you're going with the evidence. You know, that's what it sounds like. So the definition is literally the exact same thing. The other term was istishab, which is something staying in a condition until proven otherwise. Like things are halal until proven haram and people are innocent until proven guilty. That's called istishab. That's another principle of fiqh. Right?
So who makes
yes, so this has to be done by the leading ulama of the community, the ones that everybody respects and looks up to, right? So again, all of these things, whatever principles we use here, as I said, by the end of this course, you are not going to be muftis making your own fatwas. It is just to show you how the process works, right? At the end of the day, these tools have to be used by people who are trained in this field. People who spend 10 or 20 years studying Arabic, studying fiqh, studying usul al-fiqh, maqasid al-sharia, qawaid al-fiqhiyya, studying all of the madhabs. Those are the kinds of people who have to get together and discuss and arrive at conclusions based on these principles. If our community do not have those kind of people, then we are committing a sin because it's fardh kifaya. It is a communal obligation that we have such people. Otherwise, problems remain problems. You know, what's the job of ulama? To solve problems, right? So if we don't have the people qualified to solve these problems, we have to train them.
But they're making problems.
Yeah, that's so you and I have different definitions of ulama, right? When I'm talking about ulama, I'm thinking about Yusuf Qaradawi, Abdullah bin Bayya, Salman al-Awda. I'm not thinking about the local imam. I mean, unfortunately, they're not trained on the same level. This is the level they're supposed to be trained on, you know? This is what's going to solve the problems.
Sorry, halal issue. For instance, what you call NJC will say this product is halal.
Mm-hmm.
So now it says halal.
Yeah.
So is it halal or?
It depends what the issue is. I mean, some of these are genuine issues of difference of opinion. I'll give you the point of gelatin. Right? There are literally two opinions on it, right? And it really boils down to which opinion you follow. You research both opinions, look at the evidences, look at what they're basing the evidences on, who's following the accurate definition of what gelatin is, who's not, you know, and then figure out on your own which opinion you want to follow on that. But there are literally two schools of thought on gelatin, and so there are going to be two different fatwas on each product that has gelatin in it. There is no ijma on that issue at all.
Now, this
Ibn Abbas
and Haram, but also on the marriage, where there's no, let's say there's no other prohibition on marrying Jewish Christian women,
mm-hmm.
or eating their food.
Yes.
It's been slaughtered by them. But the other part of the argument that says that today's Jews and Christians are not following their own religion properly, so are they really Jews or Christians?
Okay.
So, because that goes to where they're eating their food or marrying those women.
Okay, it's a good question.
And where do you then draw the line according to?
That's a good question.
Trinity,
Christianity. No, it's okay. So the question is, the Jews and Christians of today are not like the Jews and Christians of then, so we can't. That's a false presumption, because Trinity came into existence 300 years before the Prophet's time, right? At the Council of, I forgot the name. I'm very tired today. I'm sorry. So that's when he came, 300 years before the Prophet's time. By the time of the Prophet ﷺ, the Christians were already believing in the Trinity. The Quran speaks about the Trinity. It says, don't say Trinity, don't say Jesus is God. At the same time, the same Quran says you're allowed to eat their food. Right? So it's nothing to do with that. In general, any practicing Jew or Christian's food would be halal. The problem today is with those people who are Christian by name but atheist in their practice. Yes, they're cultural Christians. This is the problem today. So The opinion, I've discussed this with many ulama around the globe, the opinion I follow, last year I was with Sheikh Yasir Qadi, I was discussing this with him, and his opinion and my opinion were exactly the same. So I think I rather attribute it to him than to me, so nobody fights with me about it. But basically kosher is fine. Right? Kosher meat will be fine. That literally fits the categories of halal according to Ahlul Kitab. But unless you're in a country where the Christians are religious, don't take a chance with Christian food. Because technically in countries like South Africa and America, the majority of Christians aren't taking the religion seriously enough to really to be considered Ahlul Kitab, in a sense where we can be confident that the food is halal. It could be. It is when you're in doubt about food, when you're in doubt, you stay away. Right? Now if you travel to a country where everyone's a religious Christian, and they take their religion very seriously, and they're slaughtering in the name of God, and they're doing these things, then I would say it's halal to eat their food. The Sahaba did that. The Jews still do that today. That's why I say kosher is allowed. Right? Marrying them, I would say, it boils down to maslaha and mafsada, the benefits and harms. That's what it boils down to. In each case, you weigh the benefits and harms. I would say in South Africa, most of the time, the harms outweigh the benefits. Also, you're forgetting the Quran says, muhsanat min al-kitab, the chaste woman of the Jews and Christians, meaning they've never committed zina. Right? And most of the cases that deal with in South Africa, where a guy brings his Christian girlfriend to get married, neither he or she are chaste. Right? So the ruling is not going to apply there.
It's fine for those two people to get married to
each other. No. The Quran is very specific here. It has a very specific clause mentioned for that. For the food, it just says, وَتَعَامُ مُحِلُ, you know, the food is halal for you. But for the marriage, it says, وَمُحْسَنَاتِ مِنَ أَهْلِ الْكِتَابِ. It specifically mentions that the condition of being chaste. Right? So therefore, it's more stricter there. So that's my view right now. My view right now is, in the practicing Christians, and kosher meat is fine, but the average Christian today, where they're having a crisis of faith and most of them don't take their religion seriously, I would not eat their meat. I won't even say it's haram. I will just say out of precaution, don't eat their meat. Right? Because technically, you could make an argument that it's halal based on Quran. But just to be safe, I wouldn't.
Sure. On the question of meat, I mean, today most of the meat that is slaughtered is intended for human consumption.
Yes.
Obviously, it's something that is advised, it's not carried out. But if you eat it and pronounce the name of the Almighty,
In Islam, we have very strict conditions for something to be halal. Right? It's not a matter of it just being slaughtered for human consumption. It's a matter of it being slaughtered in a specific way, and also in the Hanafi Mazhab, the name of Allah has to be mentioned. Right? That's necessary. You have to mention the name of Allah. Now, Jews do that when they're slaughtering the kosher meat, and Muslims do that when you're slaughtering our meat. And this is why I only put those two categories as halal. Right? Everybody else doesn't do that these days. Right? So therefore, it doesn't matter what was the intention behind it being slaughtered. It's not done in the way that fulfills the conditions for it to be halal. There are specific conditions, certain parts being cut, and you know, saying, mentioning the name of Allah, all of that has to be done before it becomes halal. You can't just say Bismillah when it's on your plate. The Bismillah will be said before slaughtering it.
And another one, also a minor issue, is a lot of the sisters, they avoid praying when they have, for example, when they have a few tips, and help all of these.
I didn't hear the question clearly.
Some of the sisters, when they want to pray, they have makeup or perfume. Mm-hmm. They wouldn't pray because of the alcohol.
But that's not considered alcohol. That's a chemical. That's not the intoxicant. So that needs to be made clear to our people.
And also, it's not an intoxicant.
Yes, it's not an intoxicant. It's a chemical. It's just a chemical that has the same name. One of the rules of fiqh is that a name of something doesn't make it haram. It's the effects of it. Right? So if I had to call a piece of chicken pork, it doesn't make the piece of chicken haram. Right? It's not a name, the name makes no difference. What the actual thing is. So the chemical alcohol is not haram. It's intoxicants are haram, even if they're not called alcohol. Right? That's what the Sharia prohibits.
But studying animal, is it
Yes.
Animal.
Okay, so stunning an animal, are you saying would it make the meat haram, or is that what you're asking? It, technically, if after that they said Bismillah and they slaughtered their veins, the process is haram, but the meat's still halal. Technically. Yes, okay. But just one last point here, right? Technically, I just want to mention one point here. In Islam, especially in the Hanafi madhab, if there is a haram condition in something, but everything else is fine, the whole thing doesn't become void. So many of the ways that people slaughter animals in this country, contain things that are haram, but also the final thing that's done is halal. So we would say it's halal for us to eat that meat, in most cases. Like, I'm not giving general fatwa for everything, but I'm saying the general ruling, it would be halal to eat the meat, but the people doing those actions are committing a sin. Do you understand? We make a difference between the people committing the sin and the meat being halal. Right? Now again, I'm not going to give specific fatwa on the specific point you mentioned, but that's the general rule in the Hanafi madhab. And I think we'll stop there, inshallah.